I'd like to welcome all our friends here. Thank you so much for coming. We're gonna try to be right on time. I know around lunchtime everybody's very busy, especially during the week in New York City. For those who don't know me, my name is Ziad Abdel Nour. I'm president of the U.S. Committee for Free Lebanon, and I've been a board member of the Middle East Forum since inception, since 1994, for the last 14 years right now. I would like to thank Scott Rosenblum and the law officers of Quaymer Levin. Unfortunately, Scott is not going to be able to be here today. Before I introduce our distinguished speaker, David Wormser, please allow me to tell you a bit about the Middle East Forum and the other sister organizations associated with this event. Since it was founded by Daniel Pipes in 1994, the Forum has become one of the most important and influential think tanks on Middle East affairs. Three strengths distinguish the Forum. Number one, it's right on the issues. It's often really ahead of the curve in identifying them. The focus really of the Forum in this position is on fighting radical Islam. It's really sponsoring groundbreaking projects, the Legal Project, Middle East Quarterly, Islamist Watch, etc. We're all established because the Forum identified a problem and figured out how to address it. Its reach is really dramatic. The Forum's three websites consistently attract over 500,000 visitors a month, which is by far the highest number for any organization providing Middle East focused information. I invite you to visit the Forum's website at www.meforum.org. I would also like to thank all the board members and supporters of the U.S. Committee for Free Lebanon and the Lebanese Foundation for Peace, the two other organizations very much working in tandem since 1997 in promoting freedom and democracy in Lebanon. Please, if you could switch all your cell phones, I would appreciate. Please also hold all your questions until after Mr. Wormser talk, at which point Joseph Skelly will moderate the question and answer. Let me tell you a couple of words about David Wormser, a distinguished expert on Middle East policy. Mr. Wormser served as Middle East advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney, special assistant to John Bolton at the Department of State, and is a former fellow of the American Enterprise Institute. In 2000, he contributed to the Middle East Forum's Lebanon Study Group report entitled Ending Syria's Occupation of Lebanon, the U.S. Role, which I personally co-authored with Daniel Pipes, and which condemned Syria's occupation of Lebanon and the weakness of U.S. foreign policy. Mr. Wormser is the author of numerous influential papers and three books, including America's Failure to Defeat Saddam Hussein. He received a PhD in International Relations from Johns Hopkins University. Please join me in welcoming David Wormser.
Thank you, Ziad. And by the way, in all the time I was in government, I was so proud to have been a signatory to that study group. That a lot of people made comments about it, and I was quite happy. And I want to thank the Middle East Forum for having me here, and in absentia, I'd like to thank Daniel Pipes for having me here. I really appreciate it. It's quite an honor. It's a distinguished group, so I'm very pleased to be here. Okay, my talk today is really about Lebanon, but I think to talk about Lebanon, one really has to talk about the larger conflict that's emerging in the region. Well, emerging, it's changing its face in the region, and it's becoming far more dangerous. Unfortunately, You know, it's 2005, 2008, about 3 years after the Cedar Revolution, which is almost 1 week away from its anniversary. We can talk, unfortunately, about a tragedy in Lebanon right now again, the inability to get a new president, and so forth. I think that the tragedy of Lebanon, despite the March 14th revolution, which was really an attempt to tear Lebanon away from its past and have the Lebanese people define their future, it's the tragedy is that Lebanon still is the key battleground right now between the West as a whole, I believe, the West as a whole, and the forces that seek to drag the Middle East down. Now, that said, I think it's precisely because the March 14th movement won that it became such an essential component as a target for those forces that are attacking us. And let me be clear about who those forces are, because I'd really like to dedicate most of what I'm saying today to those forces. It is Iran, it is Syria, it is Hezbollah, and it is the forces that are aligned with them in the region, and in general, the sort of politics they bring. The reason why I want to talk about them, and then I'll circle back again to Lebanon and why, and explain why I'm saying Lebanon is such a key battleground. I think Iran is undergoing a transformation. It's not the transformation that's so deeply hoped for in European capitals towards some more moderate camp. I don't even think it's the sort of transformation that in a more sober way, but still is a rendition of that hoped for in the corridors of Foggy Bottom, State Department for, again, some sort of a leadership that would begin a process of reform or move Iran toward reform. I think the change we're seeing is fundamentally in a different direction. I think Iran is moving from a pure theocracy, which was dangerous and hard enough to deal with, to what is now essentially a theo-fascist state that is on the edge of an even more aggressive foreign policy, but is playing itself out in Gaza, has and will play itself out in Lebanon soon, I believe. Now, why do I say this? If you listen carefully to the statements coming out of even our top officials and many of the institutions that analyze the Middle East and so forth, not the Middle East forum, but others, what you'll see is this sort of a pattern. The United States imposed sanctions on Iran. Great. The United States got the UN Security Council, after years of trying, in coordination with the Europeans, to impose sanctions on Iran. Great. Those sanctions started having an effect on Iran. They hurt the Iranians, they hurt the regime, they hurt the economic foundations that create the public support for the regime. The results they show, according to this argument, is you look at the elections in December 2006, one was local elections, key body of the Iranian government also faced elections, and the council, and those elections, which is also the body that chooses the next supreme leader of Iran, Rafsanjani's people won. Now, embedded in this is an assumption that Rafsanjani is some sort of a moderate, but nevertheless, the feeling is that Rafsanjani is more of a pragmatic guy than Ahmadinejad, the current president of Iran, and you started seeing the first effects of the pressure. Namely, you're seeing the popularity and altitude that Ahmadinejad had begin to sink. Added to that, this argument would go, you take what happened in September this year, or September 2007, a few months ago, which is that Khamenei added on to some of Rafsanjani's titles, implying that he added on to him some portfolios. Namely that Rafsanjani has been further empowered, again at the expense of Ahmadinejad. And then you had some statements by Khamenei himself saying that that were seen to be attacks on Ahmadinejad. Namely, one has to also think about the pragmatic consequences of the ideology. And that was generally seen to be an attack on Ahmadinejad. I think what we're seeing here is exactly what Sovietologists, or most of them, missed in 1986, 87, 88, and 89, which is Sovietologists were experts in Kremlinology. They looked at the Kremlin wall. They could tell you who's on top. They could tell you what that means in terms of who controls the institution of the Kremlin, because that was a very rigid structure. And from even the smallest move of one guy being bumped down the line, you could make a political assessment. What they could not understand by 88, 89 is the Kremlin didn't matter. And that is what's happening in Iran. I think that there's a growing confidence in our government that over the long term, with the pressures that we're adding on and on and on to the Iranian regime, that we're beginning to see the shift and personnel or the weight of who's in control, and that over time that will reach a critical mass that will have an effect on policy as well, and then we can over the long term have some sort of a change in the character of the regime in Iran, not change of regime but change in its behavior. Again, the problem I'm sensing is that we're not looking at the right measures. There seems to me to be a whole new power structure emerging in Iran. And it is anchored to Ahmadinejad. I think he's more the face of it than the actual only sole controller of it. But one of the first acts that Ahmadinejad did when he took over was to fire a number of people in the MOIS, the structure that's responsible both for internal security but also kind of external operations, and replaced it with an Iranian Revolutionary Guard figure named Mohsen Ejai. And Mohsen Ejai's chief mission was to invigorate and to make more active and aggressive the foreign policy activities of the MOIS, specifically terrorism. The second key move was, I think, the putting in of a new head of the IRGC. This happened only fairly recently. Again, IRG, he comes from more the traditional IRGC structure. He was head of the Basijis, which is odd. But nevertheless, he comes from a certain crowd within the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC. You see the constant statements broadcast over state media by two key ayatollahs, Mesbah Yazdi and Garavian, both of whom are very different than the traditional ayatollahs you've seen on Iranian TV. Finally, and I think this is the key sign, was Ali Larijani, who again is no moderate, and neither is Rafsanjani, by the way. But nevertheless, his removal in October as essentially the national security advisor of Iran, and replaced with a guy named Saeed Jalili. Nobody knew anything about this man, Saeed Jalili. But I think this was the key moment. Saeed Jalili is a veteran of the IRGC. He fought in the Iran-Iraq War, was mutilated in that war. He is a thinker. He's written quite a bit, which is why it's so surprising that everybody, even in our government, sort of threw up their hands when he took over and was like, well, we don't know anything about him. He's published extensively, and when you read his books, and the key one, it was one written in 1990 called The Foreign Policy of the Prophet, you get a blueprint of what Iran is doing. And more specifically, exactly what he wrote in that book is exactly what you see practically the Iranian government is doing. He had, obviously the book, when he wrote it, The Foreign Policy of the Prophet, he was talking about the period, the early period of Islam, but it was very clear he was talking about Iran today through the lens or through the language of the early period of Islam. And he had a number of things in the book that he noted. One was the prophet at one point got very sick of the emissaries that he had out there trying to, because they did in a very traditional tribal way, they tried to be in between the two tribes and negotiate between two tribes as he was trying to expand Islam in the early part from tribe to tribe. And he said the prophet at one point pulled them all in and said, no, your job is to be the face of Islam. You are to proselytize. You are not trying to negotiate. And he fired them, essentially, in those terms. What was the, after Mohsen Ejai was appointed, what was the first act that Ahmadinejad did? He fired hundreds of ambassadors and brought ambassadors in that he said would be carrying the word of Allah rather than negotiating between Iran and the rest of the world. There's a whole series of actions like that that you'd see in the book. So it's very clear that this is, on some level, Saeed Jalili is the mind behind Ahmadinejad. The second thing that, by the way, and this is also very important, is Saeed Jalili wrote in the book that early on, Muhammad and then his successors sent letters out to the other tribes saying, essentially in coded words, convert or you will face the sword. Then he sent the next wave of letters out to the various great leaders, including Byzantium and to Persia, essentially the same thing, which was an amazing act by essentially a tribal movement facing down the two superpowers at the time. Again, what does Ahmadinejad do when he comes to power? He sends letters to Bush. And again, the coded language in those letters is essentially, follow the true path or you will face the consequences. This wasn't an attempt to come to terms on a religious basis with a fellow God-fearing person. This was a warning to the West that you either get in line now or you will face serious consequences, namely destruction, soon. Again, lifted straight out of Saeed Jalili's book. So this crowd seems to be the ones who have their finger on the actual activities of the Iranian government abroad. What does it mean? Who are they? These guys have also written an awful lot about the Gulf War, the 1980 to 1988 war between Iran and Iraq, the first Gulf War. And their argument is as follows. The Ayatollahs of Qom. Qom is a seminary in Iran. It is sort of the center, the focal point, the center of gravity of the Ayatollahs of Iran. This is it is essentially a rational school that achieved a very dramatic and odd and weird and dangerous result in its rational argumentation. But nevertheless, it's a school that still anchors itself to rationalism. But it was a revolution against Shiism as well. This school in Qom defined the Iranian Revolution. But these guys are arguing that the Ayatollahs of Qom were not really true revolutionaries. They were opportunistic interlopers. They saw the revolution happening, they joined because they thought they could benefit from it, and then they controlled it. But throughout the period that they were in power, they never really managed to ever come to terms with the revolution. So for these guys, they call the Iran-Iraq War, they call two wars. The first war is called the Clergy's War, and the second one is called the Glorious War. I'm getting into this detail because you have to climb into their mindset to understand what it is they're trying to do now. The Clergy's War was the war in which, and I'm speaking here, say, as an IRGC officer, you know, we IRGC parried thrust after thrust after thrust of Iraqi invasions. We had defensive victories, and we were ready to go on the offense. The Mahdi, the 12th Imam who disappeared almost 1,000 years ago, and Allah were delivering us victories, and these timid, cowardly clergy pulled back in the last moment, quite frightened of the implications, and were happy with these defensive victories. So we could never turn the war on the offense and begin to defeat Saddam Hussein. Then the second part of the war, we IRGC officers who paid in blood and owned this revolution through the payment of our blood, turned the war around. We didn't listen to the clergy, and we took the war onto the offense, and we were just about to defeat Saddam Hussein when these clergy stepped in again and signed a ceasefire and betrayed the will of Allah. And they used that word. I mean, Saeed Jalili used that word about Khomeini, that he betrayed the will of Allah by signing that ceasefire. Very serious language. Now, why do I bring all this up? Because they're arguing that on policy after policy after policy, the Iranian government has been far too timid. The West is finished. The West has no will. Allah is on their side. The hidden Imam, the Mahdi, the 12th Imam who went into occultation 1,000 years ago, is on the verge of returning. These are true believers. And And now that we're beginning to take control of policy, we will show the world that all this strategizing, restraint, and so forth of the previous 25 years of the Iranian Revolution is over, and we will expose the West as a collapsing hollow tree. The Ayatollahs aligned with them, by the way, are more oriented toward a city in northeastern Iran, Mashhad. If any of you are familiar with Judaism, it would be as if the center of gravity of Judaism shifted from sort of the rational school to Kabbalah and Tzfat in northern Israel, except add to it an apocalyptic element. And then you get an idea of the wedding of IRGC officers, essentially fascist officers, with a theocratic movement that is much more mystical and apocalyptic, and the idea that the West has no will, and that who is now in charge in Iran. So what you're seeing is a very aggressive shift in Iran. Always was aggressive. They always were at war with us. But what you're seeing is a much more acute and tenacious and risk-seeking enemy. And I think you're seeing it play out first in the 2006 war in Lebanon, and then I think you're seeing it playing out right now in Gaza. Lebanon, I think, is very interesting because I think you did see a fissure emerge. And again, it's somewhat along the lines of what's going on in Tehran. And this tells you exactly how much Lebanon is still the battleground. I think there were some local elements, and I differ actually from the Israeli intelligence estimate, our estimate on this, but local forces were, on the eve of the war, were basically arguing, look, we, in March 2005, we Hezbollah took on the Lebanese political establishment and lost. We made an enemy of every community in Lebanon. We stood for Syria's presence, even though most of the Syrian workers were taking jobs from Shiites in the south. We stood on behalf of Arab nationalism, when Arab nationalism is seen by Shiites mostly as a cover for Sunni dominance. We stood with Syria, which Lebanese see as their enemy. We stood out on a limb. We're on very weak ground. And if you pick a war with Israel, then there won't be a rally around the flag phenomenon. Most Lebanese will side with Israel against us, and we'll be dead. Tehran basically argued, no, you have no future trying to rehabilitate yourself in a narrow Lebanese context. Your future ultimately lies with our regional victory, because that regional victory will then redound to your advantage locally, politically, in Lebanon. You will derive your strength through us, not the other way around. Tehran won, and in my sense, that's really the genesis of the war. Then they sought escalation. You could see throughout the spring of 2006, what actually triggered the war was in July, but you saw several events throughout 2006 that pretty clearly signaled that they were looking for front-wide escalation, and that they were willing to take quite a hit in this war in order to deliver to Iran a strategic victory. So at any rate, I wanted to throw that out and then return it back to Lebanon to show that if you look at it that way, Lebanon has become one of the two or three key battlegrounds right now between Iran and the West as a whole. And it's going to get a lot worse with this, if my interpretation of what's going on in Tehran is correct. So.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. My name is Dr. Joseph Skelly, and I'll be moderating the discussion period. On behalf of the Middle East Forum, I'd like to thank Dr. Wormser for his insightful and compelling remarks today. Before we begin the questions, on behalf of the forum, I'd also like to thank two of the forum's New York board members who have co-sponsored this event, Scott Rosenblum of the law offices of Kramer, Levin, Neftalis, and Frankel, and Ziad Abdelnour, our friend, who conceptualized the program and worked very hard to ensure its success. During the question and answer period, as I call on you, would you mind identifying yourself and your affiliation? And I'd like to begin the discussion period with a question from Ziad.
Thank you, Joe. Dr. Unser, assuming you were to become one of the top key advisors to John McCain, assuming he wins, which I hope he does, the presidential elections, what are the three specific top recommendations you would push for with him to basically, in order to promote U.S. interests in the region, in the Middle East, in Lebanon specifically?
Okay. In the region, Middle East, and Lebanon specifically. Let me just bluntly answer that.
Please,
and say
be,
why.
Be as blunt as you can.
One, abandon the two-state solution statement that we have right now vis-a-vis the Palestinians. Two, well, let me start with number one. Number one is an open advocate, an open, publicly expressed regime change strategy in Iran.
Okay.
One. Two, an open, expressed regime change strategy in Syria. And three, abandoning the two-state solution policy that we've had right over the last, actually, frankly, since just around 9/11 attacks.
And I'm sorry, David, one exception to that. How would that be possible given the forces of change, Nancy Pelosi in Congress and the others, the liberal forces that will be waging war against UK regarding this policy?
Okay, let me first explain why I said in that order. Again, I mean, given what I said, then obviously we're headed for essentially a major conflict with Iran that won't end nicely. So we have to figure out how to defeat Iran. The earlier you defeat them, the earlier you bring the regime down, the less of a cost this war will eventually bring. I mean, down the road, you could imagine a horrific war. The key strategic thrust of the Iranian regime is a fundamental shift over the last 4 years. In the first 25 years of the Iranian Revolution, what you saw was a revolution that actually failed more or less to transcend the Shiite Persian prison that it was trapped in. It tried very hard to go beyond that, but it failed. Ultimately, it stood against Arab nationalism because it still had as its core foundation the defense of Shiite interests, many of whom were opposed to the Arab nationalism. Again, Sunni Islam, it just couldn't get any traction among Sunni Muslims and so forth. If you look at what Iran has done in the last 4 years, it's a very bold move. First, instead of trying to defeat Arab nationalism, it is trying to co-opt it. The Arab-Israeli conflict for it has become a critical element to play and a key emotive issue in Arab nationalism, the existence of Israel. It is taking leadership away from the Sunni world on this. It's taking away leadership from the Arab world on this issue. But to do that, it needs to constantly deliver a set of victories. Now, that's not to say that they haven't fought Israel via Hezbollah before, but now it has become a central part of Iran's national policy is to have an active hot war with Israel through its proxies and constantly have a stream of victories so that it can embarrass the regional leadership and seize the banner of Islam as a whole from that leadership by saying, we are leading the Muslims to victory. The second thing that it's doing is, and this is the irony of where the Iranian regime is going, it's watering down its Shiism. Some of what it's doing abroad is bizarrely Sunni. It has some of its ayatollahs working on various analyses and so forth to bring the Sunni world closer. But most importantly, what it's doing is it's directly appealing to the traditions in Sunni Islam that when there is a jihad, you follow even an unjust ruler. In other words, a Sunni Muslim is still committed under tradition or by law. This is the Maliki school, and it governs the Maliki and Hanbali school, from which most of the various Muslim Brotherhood movements and Saudis come from. that if a leader is following, if a leader is genuinely prosecuting a jihad against a non-Muslim entity, then the unity of the Muslim community is gravely endangered by any fissures in the ranks, fitna, as it's called, fissures in the ranks. And that therefore, even a good Muslim has to follow an unjust ruler, which otherwise he's not, by the way, committed to following. Now, the problem with Shiites is, are they unjust or are they apostates? Apostates need to be killed under Sunni law. Unjust is a different story. Well, what you're seeing in the last 2-3 years is even among Muslim Brotherhood leaders, watching the sort of following, the sort of almost neo-Nasserite attraction that Iran is gaining because of its successes in Lebanon and its perceived success in Gaza through Hamas, you're seeing Muslim Brotherhood leaders making arguments that in fact Shiites are true Muslims. They're not yet coming to terms with the fact that it's a legitimate school of jurisprudence, but they're making the point that they are Muslims, that the key points of how to be a Muslim. One, the Quran is the same Quran. Many Sunnis didn't believe it was. To become a Muslim, you have to say the same thing, etc., etc., etc. Once you say that, then you've removed the central obstacle for people, say, in the Muslim Brotherhood, Sunni organization, to follow Iran. So Iran's strategy really relies on seizing both Sunni Islam and seizing Arab nationalism. To do that, it needs Syria. Syria is its gateway to the Arab and Sunni worlds, even though Syria is an Alawite country, or run by Alawites, still, it is a player in Sunni politics, in Iraq, in Jordan, among the Palestinians. Syria is also the gateway to Arab nationalism. It is through Syria that they have a play, they make a play with Hamas, with the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and so forth. Moreover, it is the geographic gateway for Iran to be a player on the Arab-Israeli conflict. If Iran loses Syria as an ally, it administers to Iran a strategic blow as severe, maybe even greater, than the loss of Eastern Europe was for the Soviet Union in 1989. It simply cannot be a player in the key areas that it needs to be a player to maintain the image of a succeeding revolution in Iran. And that's key, because Ahmadinejad, I didn't get into how he came to power, but he came to power essentially because the Iranian revolution had sputtered to a crisis by 2003. And this is essentially a last gasp effort to try to reassert the Iranian revolution through extreme aggression, extreme activity, extreme energy. But it's a system that also has no shock absorbers. So if Iran faces a catastrophic strategic setback like the collapse of Syria, my bet is that you'll start seeing the process of implosion in Tehran set in. So to me, the key strategic act for regime change in Iran actually starts with a clear regime change policy in Syria. Why did I throw in the two-state solution? Because right now, that's the other area that Iran is beginning to play through. Until now, you know, Hamas had its own entity and so forth, but I think through the structures that are emerging, Syria is now playing not only through Hezbollah and Lebanon, but Hezbollah and Syria, and in the background, Iran. The key structures of power, 80% of the activity going on in Gaza right now is not through the Izzeddin al-Qassam brigades. It is through an organizational structure set up under a guy named Ahmed Jabari, through a force that he commands called the Murabitun Force, which was trained in Iran, ironically in Mashhad, was trained in Iran, and it answers directly not to Haniya in Gaza, but to Mahmoud Zahar and straight to Khalid Mashal in Damascus. This is a force that answers to Damascus and Tehran. It isn't anchored in local Palestinian politics. So, essentially, this has become the next front, akin to the way Lebanon was, Hezbollah was in Lebanon over the last few years. So, you know, that's why I said in hierarchy, Iran, Syria, by extension Hezbollah, and now you also have to deal with the situation in Gaza. And to do that, I think you're going to have to abandon the two-state solution. So that's practically how I thought. The second part was?
The second part, how likely would these suggestions likely to happen, given, you know, the forces against McCain, against following this policy, this U.S. policy, or the same, whatever, policy in the Middle East?
Well, I think sooner or later we're going to have to do these policies, because sooner or later the Iranians are going to push it to the point where sooner or later we're going to have to respond.
Gotcha.
I mean, the way this Iranian regime will go all the way until it's stopped. The question is the price we pay until we get there. So whoever's elected, I think, is going to have to deal with this, and eventually we'll face such a catastrophic situation that they'll have to deal with it. Obviously, I think, McCain, the Iranians fear McCain a lot more. He is in jest, but he's joked about bombing Iran. But more importantly, whether it's real or not, and I'm not advocating McCain over Obama or Hillary or anything, for the Iranians, if the Democrats are elected, they would read that as the American people have rejected the legacy of Bush, that it was because of Iraq, it was because the Americans lost.
The change in policy.
Right. Whereas they know that McCain is defined to some extent through the Iraq War. So it would be quite a shock to them. So,
would any members of the media have any questions? Okay, we'll continue. Sir.
Questions. We're the Iranian people, and correspondingly, do we, that is Europe and or the U.S., have the requisite will to the question?
Okay. Iranian people, it's hard to know, but my sense is that the regime probably lost most of its true currency on a popular level quite a while ago. I think what you have is a fairly passive population right now because they don't have a lot of hope. That said, from what I do hear from inside Iran, increasing fear. They're really scared of where this regime will push Iran. We've heard a lot of reports of even Ayatollahs moving their money out. Now, Ayatollahs are invested in the regime, but even they seem to be moving money out, which is a clear sign that there's a real fear emerging that this whole structure can come down. Probably not because we're going to do something to bring it down immediately, but because Iran's going to do something to push it over the brink, essentially. So that's my sense. But at the same time, they've watched us go back and forth on this issue of supporting, quote, the Iranian people against the Iranian regime. We've talked about this a number of times in 2001, 2, 3, 4, etc. I think they were deeply shocked by the European Union's initiative on the nuclear issue in 2003. Because implied in that initiative was a recognition that Europe was willing to accept this regime in Iran in the long term as a legitimate interlocutor on nuclear issues. And we acquiesced in that initiative. And I think Iranians read that acquiescence as an abandonment on some level of the rhetoric that we had had up until that point of supporting the Iranian people against the regime. Then they saw Colin Powell on the eve of what was to be a planned major demonstration, July 17th, 2003, in Tehran, say that this is an internal affair, America doesn't get involved. And then a few days later, they heard Deputy Secretary Armitage testify on the Hill that he considers Iran a democracy. So, this was broadcast all over the Iranian media. Then they saw some other signs. And I'm talking about the Iranian regime, but also the Iranian people, and the Iranian regime spared no effort in reminding the Iranian people of this. You know, and this tells you how people see things quite differently. August 2003, we go to the UN to get a UN resolution to sanction our presence in Iraq. We saw this as a major step forward to show that the world had reconciled to what we had done in Iraq, and that the tensions and the divisions prior to the war and on the eve of the war and in the midst of the war were easing, and that even Europe was beginning to come along. We talked about it even in terms, on some level, a little bit of a honeymoon. Problem is, if you're in Iran, what you saw was a superpower that suddenly, I mean, you know, in some ways we were the Sultan, and the Sultan was asking permission to rule from people who had no right to give the Sultan permission to rule. It was an act of weakness. And the Iranian regime made this point over and over again, that we turned to the UN to help extricate ourselves from a morass that we had gotten ourselves into. Perfect example of how what we do is read completely differently in the region than what we think it will be. So again, summer of 2003, key moment, and I think the Iranian people were building a certain momentum. The balloon was punctured.
And the American will.
The second question.
The American will. Again, I differ from many in Washington. I think actually the Americans fear a nuclear Iran. They haven't forgotten what they're dealing with in Iran, and they know how dangerous a nuclear Iran would be. So while I think by and large the public mood is against most military interventions, and it would take an awful lot of explaining by our government, I think if a government really came to the American people and said, we really do have a problem, Iran really is going nuclear, it really is threatening us, there's still enough will out there on the specific issue of Iran to act if necessary. As far as this administration goes, I don't believe it does. I mean, it may have the will, but it's convinced itself of that first argument that I made, which was that the sanctions are biting, they're having an effect, it's beginning to create a change inside the Iranian regime, and it's only a matter of time before you get a fundamental change then in the policies of Iran. And by the way, they also have more confidence in the Sunni bloc than I do. So they think that, in the multilateralism surrounding the Sunni bloc, Europe really frightens Iran, and I doubt it. So, yes?
Yeah, as far as your advice to McCain, there's one portion that's fully there, which is get off dependence on oil, which is so crucial to every foreign policy strategy. So I just want to answer that. But my question was, Ahmadinejad, who's been to Iraq now, sitting down with the leaders, I mean, has everything totally backfired?
Well, I think things have gone very wrong in the last few months. One of the key events was the publication of the National Intelligence Estimate last October. I mean, if you go back to the way I described the internal dynamics inside the Iranian regime, there were elements who were saying, look, we're going to defeat the West. We're at war with the West, and we're going to defeat the West. But we got to do this very cleverly and very smartly, because the West can be very dangerous. And Ahmadinejad turning around and saying, they have no will. Hit them directly, hit them hard. This is a lot like Hitler's generals in the 1930s, where with every successive crisis, he would then turn to his generals and say, you're degenerate. You have no will. The West has no will. You have no will. I know I can get away with this. And with each crisis, he increased his power doing so. That's what's going on inside the Iranian regime as well. And the National Intelligence Estimate was a very key moment. As I said, you saw Khamenei, the Supreme Leader, actually a week before the publication of the National Intelligence Estimate, the NIE, actually criticize Ahmadinejad and try to rein him in. The week afterwards, everybody in Iran was falling over themselves saying, no, I was the guy who was saying we shouldn't concede anything on the nuclear program. I was the guy who was the champion of it, et cetera, et cetera. So you almost enforced a victory to that camp, in Ahmadinejad's camp. So I think you see some of that right there.
Thank you.
That was a key moment where the dynamic sort of unraveled. But what you had follow-up.
No, I saw about Iraq.
Oh, about Iraq. Yeah, I think this is, immediately after that, you saw a number of things. Russia signed a deal for fuel deliveries to Iran, literally within a couple days, something that had been held up for 5 years. You saw Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah hold Ahmadinejad's hand in an Arab summit. More than that, look carefully at the picture. And this matters, symbolism matters in Arab society. Ahmadinejad had his hand on top of Abdullah's hand, which is a sign of respect by Abdullah to Ahmadinejad, submission essentially. So, I mean, instantly you saw the dynamics turn around in the region. People accepted that essentially Iran had won this round with the United States. So.
Thanks. Perhaps I could just ask a very quick question. While these forces play out at the strategic level, could you share with us some ideas about some concrete things we can do to support forces of democracy and freedom in Lebanon, Ziad's friends in Lebanon, while this is all playing out at the larger level?
Well, first of all, when you sit there and you see minister after minister and parliament member after parliament member being killed, or journalist after journalist being killed, and all you can do is huff and puff, that shows weakness. And Syria gets away with it, and Hezbollah gets away with it, and Iran is getting away with it. There have to be tangible, painful answers delivered to Syria and Iran each time they do something like this. We're still trying to deal with the legal, slow, legal, mechanical structure to deal with the Hariri assassination, and we're 6-7 assassinations beyond that. And we have to start coming up with serious, immediate answers delivered decisively and clearly in the hours and days after such acts happen, not years later. To this day, there really has not been any meaningful action taken in response to the assassinations of a number of the journalists, parliament members, ministers, and so forth. I mean, and it's changing the face of the Lebanese government. I mean, it's literally killing the Lebanese government out of existence. The second thing is, you have the whole crisis over the presidency and so forth. Again, Syria continues to act, Hezbollah continue to act, and yet there aren't any tangible responses to that. There are verbal responses. Now we've even moved chips to some extent. But again, Syria is not convinced that we have the will to act. Until we convince them of that, they're going to keep doing this, and they're going to keep convincing Lebanese that we're going to, at the end of the day, abandon the Lebanese, the Lebanese who are really fighting for freedom here. More than that, our only answer to that is to turn to the Saudis and to try to get the Saudis to do more to help. But the truth is, I don't think the Saudis have as much assets in Lebanon as they think they have, number one. And number two, practically, you know, they've been at odds with the Syrian regime for quite a while. If they've clearly wanted to do something about getting rid of the regime or doing something like that, they're not able. Where the rubber meets the runway is the United States. That is what will have an effect on the street in Lebanon when there's a clear sign that we, not through Saudi Arabia or through somebody else, but that we are committed to acting in Lebanon to preserve what happened in March 2005.
Like sending the U.S. 6th Fleet right now with the ships. And
that was probably the most serious thing we've done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As a clear message.
Yes.
Okay. Very good. Yes, ma'am.
Alisa Lappin with the American Center for Democracy. Two things, actually. The follow-up to the last question. Shouldn't our government basically say to the candidates and the members of Congress, hey, you cannot go to Damascus. They are our enemies. We have a Syria, we have an enemy here. You can't go there, number one. Number two, what is the meaning of the upcoming election in Iran? And how does that play into all of this?
Right, okay. first question. Absolutely. I mean, Syria, we do have, as a government, we do have the ability to tell congressmen and others not to go to Syria. It's hard, honestly, it's hard to tell the congressman not to do anything. I mean, it's not just that there's the headstrong. It is a different branch of government, so it is a very tricky thing to cross a congressman who wants to go there. But that said, you know, we're not making it clear what our policy is on Syria. I mean, I can't tell you whether our policy is to affect a change in the behavior of the regime in Damascus or to change the regime in Damascus. If it's the former, if it's to affect a change of behavior in the regime, then it's hard to make the argument that you shouldn't allow at least some back channel lines of communication with that regime so they can communicate to you that they're willing to change, or that you can communicate to them, change and you'll have this, or you don't change and then this will happen to you. So it becomes much harder, when you have a murky policy, it becomes much harder to enforce discipline like that.
Well, I'm sorry, for the footnote to that, of course, is the quote-unquote negotiations with the ME. That's not a regime change we want.
No, it's not, but that's a good point, too. But the other thing is, you know, we have sent emissaries to Damascus. In 2004, we sent Armitage there and so forth. So again, if we're sending people on the highest level to go there, we haven't done that much lately, although we did send an Assistant Secretary Sowerbrae, and so forth, just about a year ago, half a year ago. If you're sending assistant secretaries to Damascus, it's hard to tell people why it's a bad idea to go to Damascus. So it's again, the blurriness that we have is not crisply sending the signal that these guys were finished with them. The second part was
the election in Iran.
Yeah, the election in Iran. Again, I think it certainly will be an important thing, but again, my sense is that the old guard of Ayatollahs in Qom know how to master the system right now, master the visible system of power. So they probably could engineer for themselves some sort of a victory in those elections. But again, I'm not sure that's the real structure of power. So on some level, my sense is Ahmadinejad is basically just, he doesn't care. I mean, his structures of power don't depend on that. So that's why I wouldn't write off those elections. I wouldn't ignore them entirely. But I wouldn't put a lot of hopes that this is going to deliver Ahmadinejad a blow from which he cannot recover. Because until now, I sense he controls certain structures that matter more than that. So...
Excuse me.
Sorry about that.
We'll improvise. We know who sponsors this event. Okay. Sir, your question.
My name is David Schimmel. And going back to Gaza, the recent Vanity Fair article on Gaza by David Rose, where I don't know if you can tell us whether it was an accurate depiction of the failed attempt by the Bush administration to use the Fatah through Dahlan to fight Hamas, but and that you were opposed to that approach as it's described in the article. But what alternative was, why was that not a good alternative to try at least one thug against another, absent that Israel was not prepared to go in and do what's necessary?
All right. First of all, as far as the depiction, I really didn't know if there was or was not, quote, a coup attempt by Dahlan against, the specific act of a coup against Hamas. That said, and I think most people in this room who very closely follow Palestinian politics know that we sent Keith Dayton there to build up a security force under Dahlan, answering more to the president's office, which had no security forces once the elections in 2006 delivered a Hamas victory, and through that delivered the Palestinian Authority to Hamas, and through that technically, the Palestinian security organizations came under the authority of Hamas. And we built an alternative structure, and the first thing that you have to ask is to do what? I can't tell you whether we really did a coup or not. I don't know the specific things that happened last June. I have been told by Palestinians that there was such a thing, but again, I didn't see it myself. As far as using the one thug against the other, two things. One is Fatah under Abu Mazen is a dead horse. I mean, he doesn't have any real following. Even under Arafat, I mean, I think we have to look at what happened in March 2002 when Israel re-entered the West Bank. When they go in, they go right up to where Arafat is with very little resistance. They do get to Jenin and they face quite some resistance from the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and so forth. The forces that are willing to fight in those areas are not the Fatah forces. The only ones that are Fatah al-Aqsa, which is ideologically maybe Fatah, but it's in alignment, quite frankly, much closer to Hamas. So, I mean, it's sad to say, but I think, I mean, let me put it this way. The politics surrounding Fatah cannot be reformed. Fatah can't be reformed. Any attempt to ride them to defeating Hamas is doomed to failure because they will not be able to have any real following. Now, you have to go to what happened in January 2006, the elections for Hamas. I think there are two parts to it. One was what we wanted to see, which was a rejection of the PLO. Wonderful. Palestinians didn't like the PLO. Corrupt, this was a vote for freedom, etc. That's one interpretation, and I think there was some element of that. But I think there was another one too. I was there in January 2006, and you go to the falafel stands, you go to stores in the West Bank, you saw pictures of Nasrallah, and you saw pictures of Ahmadinejad. They had become the new Nasser, and Palestinians began to embrace this new Nasser. The vote for Hamas among many Palestinians was an attraction to Hamas as the local representative of what they saw to be the new answer to the West. And I think it was a genuine expression. So, now I know some on the left would want me to say then you accept a Hamas government. No, and this is where I get to the two-state solution question. If the Palestinians genuinely express their will around Hamas, then they have chosen to define their national will, at least for the moment, around terrorism and a war against the West. And there are consequences to that. So for me, I know the big question is Israel doesn't seem to have the will to go back in. But I think for the moment, that's going to be the only answer that Israel has. It will deal with these missiles, and it will deal with missiles with Hamas continuing to build up as the strategic vanguard of Iran right there on their borders until they have the will to go back in. But at this point, I mean, I don't see any alternative. And then we can get back to some sort of a political structure. But for the moment, that's the only alternative.
Okay, thank you. We have time for one more question. Did any of your friends from Lebanon?
Can you ask
one?
No.
Question, please.
The United States has been relying on Saudi mediation in the Arab-Israeli conflict for more than 2-3 decades in the Middle East. And Saudi was very active against the Russian occupation of Afghanistan. Bandar bin Sultan personally was financing a lot of these operations in Afghanistan. And finally, the relying on such a dynamic about the 9/11 events for the United States. Most of them were Saudis, and these people were financed by Prince Bandar bin Sultan. Do you see the Saudi strategy in the Middle East part of the solution or part of the problem? And for the future, is the foreign policy of the U.S. is it going to rely on Saudi mediation, or is it going to take a different alternative, try to find solutions for terrorists, especially that we in Lebanon are getting a lot of reports that the Saudis are funneling arms to Sunni extremists, or Wahhabis and jihadists to challenge the Hezbollah phenomenon inside Lebanon. But you don't solve a problem with another problem. You solve a problem with a solution. And relying, we Lebanese know that relying on the Saudis, relying on another Hezbollah problem, that it's not going to be Shia, it's going to be Sunni.
Yeah, we also see the Syrians funneling money to some Sunni al-Qaeda-based organizations too. So, you know, it's you don't even have the Sunni extremist Sunnis behind you. You have the split within that camp.
There are, in fact, on both sides of Syria.
Exactly. The Saudis. Nothing will replace American leadership. And by that I mean, if we are going to do what we need to do to win, then the Saudis will be our ally. If we think that we're going to win through the Saudis as a replacement for our leadership, then the Saudis will gauge us as weak. And my sense is, and I think that the bin Laden phenomenon is a very complex one, it is not as the Saudi regime portrays it, as an enemy of the regime per se, outright, straight, clean, black and white. It's a mix. If they gauge us as deferring to them, then they will see, and it's not their preferred route. Their preferred route is to have us win and then raise their hand and say, hey, we were your ally all along, now you owe us. Their preferred route is that. But if backed up against the wall, they will play through bin Laden-esque forces. You will see a radicalization of Saudi Arabia. And that is essentially what happened in the 1980s, the result of which were the madrasa structures in places like Pakistan. I mean, we see the Saudis as the engine of defeating the Soviet Union. I question exactly how central they were. I mean, they had certainly a role to play, but that structure they set up was also set up to counter the Iranian Revolution, the madrasa structures and so forth, from which emerged the movements that led to 9/11. So when you build up the Saudis as your vehicle through which you get things done in the region, you may now be on a far larger strategic level recreating the same failure that you did in the 1980s.
Only in the region, we have another mistake that happened a few weeks ago in Serbia. They created the state of Kosovo in the Balkans and defeated the Christian supported state that potentially defended Europe, especially that the Bosnian during World War II fought with the Germans against the ally, against the American, especially that these Al-Qaeda is very well established in the Kosovo area. And
well, I think even beyond, I mean, not Kosovo per se, but I think in Bosnia, and the Bosnian government's a different issue, but I think it's a very, right there you see how complex this relationship between bin Laden and the Saudi regime is. There's mosques that were built, especially two key mosques that were built in Bosnia, financed by Yasin al-Qadi, who's a financier of al-Qaeda, anchored to a key figure inside Saudi Arabia, Wail Julaydan, who seems to be protected by two key princes, Prince Salman and Prince Naif. In one is the governor of Riyadh, the other is Qasim, governor of Qasim, whatever. What you see is a mixture. I mean, key financiers and financial structures. By the way, Wail Julaydan was expelled from Bosnia by the Bosnian government as a persona non grata for involvement with al-Qaeda in Bosnia in 1995.
Why is the U.S. foreign policy that contradictory? It claims it's fighting al-Qaeda and radicalism everywhere in the world, and it helps create a radical state in the heart of Europe.
Because I don't think it's, I think it, you put your finger on it with Bandar and so forth. I think the perception in Washington is that al-Qaeda is the mortal enemy of the Saudi regime. Whereas I think, and you can get a lot of trouble in Washington saying that the regime in Riyadh plays footsie with al-Qaeda. But I don't think you can get around the math of 17 of 19 hijackers. I don't think you can get around the problem that no Saudi regime target was targeted by al-Qaeda until 2003. And then it was Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's units who did it, who seemed to be were in a fight with Zawahiri and bin Laden, many of whom passed through Syria and wound up in Fatah al-Islam linked to Syria. So to me, the shift in al-Qaeda seems more to do with the Syrian-Saudi tensions than they do with al-Qaeda as the enemy of Saudi Arabia. So again, I think it's an extremely complex picture with al-Qaeda, and the Saudi regime plays it both ways. And if they see us dropping the ball entirely and they feel more and more threatened by Iran, their answer isn't going to be to more and more run into our arms. My sense is they're more and more going to run for radicalism.
Thank you so very much.
Dr. Wormser, thank you for sharing these insights. What we learned today is that there's so much at stake for the West in Lebanon, and we also realize that there's so much at stake for Lebanon, and we greatly appreciate your remarks. And on behalf of the Middle East Forum, I'd like to thank you, and I'd like to thank our board members, and I'd like to thank all of you for attending. Thank you once again.
Thank you very much.